security analysts that run around all year long fixing major issues at businesses and helping them figure out how to prevent those sorts of issues in the future. And because they really do stuff nationwide, they have just a really an excellent sampling of what is occurring and the trends amongst the and the patterns amongst what's happening. And what they do every year is put out the Verizon Data Breach Digest report, and then I love to analyze it because I think it's highly entertaining. I mean, first of all, you learn tons of things from it just in terms of saying, gee, is what we're doing for our business protective? Meaning, are the security mitigations that we have in place at our business, would that have prevented the issue that the Verizon team found at that particular investigation point? And so there's tons of things to learn from it. So let's get started. This is part four. The other three parts are listed on the Breakfast Bites podcast section of qualityplusconsulting.com if you'd like to see that. And there is also a marked up version of the Verizon Data Breach Report with our comments on it for your entertainment and reading pleasure. And if there's any time left in the show, I'll talk a tad bit about the WannaCry and Intel AMT thing, which I'm sure you've all heard about the WannaCry ransomware. However, you probably haven't heard about the Intel AMT problem. All right, so let's get started. Scenario 15 in the report talks about data ransomware, which is rather timely considering that the WannaCry ransomware has been running wild in the past few weeks here. And in this particular scenario that they analyzed, they found that Adobe Flash-related malware was a transportation vehicle for this particular ransom in breach scenario 15. And this all comes down to the things I've been saying for the last 16 years: is please just patch your software. And I think a lot of people don't understand how important it is. They think that, yeah, I'm just going to use my computer and the software is going to pop up and prompt me to install it and update. I can tell you that in the vast majority of circumstances, your software does not pop up and tell you to patch it in any level of a timely fashion. It may not pop up and tell you to patch it at all. So if you don't have a mechanism where you are actively assessing and inventorying the installed version of said software packages on all of your endpoints, then how do you know it's up to date? And then you also need to be plugged into an information stream that tells you when there's new versions of different software packages available. So in the grand scheme of things, either you need to be an IT expert or you need to outsource it. And if you don't have one of those two things going on, then you probably have a hole in your security strategy because patching is super important. And by the way, patching computers in a timely fashion was one of the big mitigation components to mitigating the risk of the WannaCry ransomware. Okay, so in scenario 15, they also expose the fact that the botnet detection at this location wasn't working. And so botnet detection at the network layer blocks access to rotating command and control domains, and you need to know that. So if you're using a perimeter security solution that does not have botnet detection in it, then you're leaving yourself open to the command and control rootkit backdoor infection vectors that will start egressing. If they do get in, then they can start egressing. And a lot of the game here is to protect yourself on the inbound, which is ingressing, and on the outbound, which is egressing. So if something does get onto your computer, we can stop it through the cybersecurity kill chain by preventing that command and control phone home data leakage technology from going back out. So let's take the WannaCry thing as an example. Let's say you had an APT blocking capability in your perimeter security appliance. Well, great. Then WannaCry would probably be killed by that alone. But let's say you didn't have that, and you at least had a perimeter security appliance with IPS and AV scanning and things like that. then it would probably be detected on the outbound side when it was trying to egress, and especially if you had botnet detection in there, right? So it tries to phone home to the mothership and get an encryption key code and things like that, and a perimeter security appliance properly configured, properly maintained, thoroughly patched, of course, also ends up in more protections because it prevents the bad doo-doo from coming in to begin with, and if bad doo-doo is inside, it can prevent it from phoning home to the nasty mothership. And of course, it needs to alert you on this. There needs to be monitoring. Some IT people need to be being aware of the notifications and responding to those. All right, scenario 16 in the Verizon Data Breach Digest report is talking about sophisticated malware, specifically the thing called Flea Flicker. And I thought was highly entertaining about this was that they went into this customer's environment and they were trying to investigate what was happening on, they were trying to basically find the forensic history of what happened. And what they ended up realizing was that egress traffic was not being logged at all, and therefore they had no possibility of correlating NATed traffic to any sort of an internal system. And I read this and I just started laughing because I'm thinking to myself, how does it happen that there's no long-term data for the network traffic? I mean, like perimeter security appliance traffic. Long-term SIM logging is mandatory. A botnet blocking system, would have also blocked this malicious malware because it was phoning home to the mothership specifically through port 53 DNS. And, I've talked tons and tons about the critical importance of using a DNS proxy. And of course, you have to have DNS logging too. But actually, I mean, it frustrates me when I run into people who are like, well, we don't want to have a SIM log because it's too expensive. I'm like, really? Because all you got to do is go get a PC and put like Hyper-V on it, which is free, and then put up your free SIM logging server. Wow. So what did that cost you? Well, it cost you a PC. And that was probably a PC you had laying around. Right? So I say all that because I find it just frustrating that people keep coming up with excuses as to why they can't have a SIM logging system when SIM logging systems are oftentimes free. I mean, nobody says you have to have a SIM logging system that is the level of capabilities of what a Fortune 500 company has, but to have no logs whatsoever of egress traffic, that is just disastrous. You have no ability to go back and look at, well, what happened? Gee, when did this thing start to become a problem, right? So as I said, they found that in this case, the malware, well, it got on a system and then it egressed over port 53 DNS. There was no DNS proxy. They couldn't correlate the data because there was no SIM logging. And then they found that it was that the way that the network was set up is that it enabled peer-to-peer malware infection. Now, this is also really relevant because, again, the WannaCry ransomware is peer-to-peer infection vector. It's specifically cramming through the SMB channel. So the SMB channel is like file and print sharing. And in reality, turning off file and print sharing in any level of a business environment is just not even possible. I mean, you can't go and disable SMB and then run your, and SMB, by the way, is server message block, which is the way that computers access servers through UNC paths or drive mappings. You can't disable that because, well, gee, now people can't access file shares on the server, so that'd be a little bit of a problem, right? So how do you deal with something like a ransomware like this WannaCry stuff? Well, number one, you have to patch the heck out of everything. Now, if all your systems are actually patched and then there was a computer that did get onto your network that was infected with that, then the peer-to-peer communication channel is going to be blocked at one level or another. So at one level, Let's say we're talking about trusted PCs on one subnet with things on the trusted wireless on another subnet. Now, from the wireless to the regular PCs that are wired, you're going to traverse the perimeter security appliance because it's also the core router. And IPS is probably going to pick that up and say, no, bad to-do, block that. But that's only if your network is structured correctly to make that work. But then, what if you don't have that sort of structure? Well, if you would have patched your systems, then theoretically the systems that are patched do not have that SMB vulnerability anymore, which was the infection vector for WannaCry. Okay. Well, then the Verizon team in this scenario 16 ended up finding a piece of the malware. They reversed engineer it, and they found something really interesting. Was that the malware contained various entropy settings that allowed it to randomize its communication over an encrypted channel, which caused it to avoid DLP. Now, DLP is data loss protection or data loss prevention, and it's pretty amazing that that's some pretty sophisticated high-end stuff. And ultimately, though, all of this stuff with this particular malware infection could have been stopped and prevented with just standard, proper network security strategies. So, I mean, there's nothing exotic going on there in terms of the mitigations, right? Scenario 17 is RAM scraping, which you oftentimes find with point of sale systems, right? Where we do our credit card swiping. That's called a point of sale system. And the digital evidence that they generally get from these is they dump RAM from a POS system, and they then are trying to figure out what is the malware, and they're trying to figure out what it was communicating to, how it possibly got in, and things like that. Well, in this particular scenario, what they found was that this customer who got compromised and their POS system ended up getting compromised, they found that the perimeter protection devices alerted on issues but did not block the communications to suspicious remote addresses. So it alerted, but it didn't block. And of course, the resulting list of these remote addresses ended up being these, a bunch of malware delivery servers, right? So, you know what this smells like? It smells like Target all over again because Target spent millions of dollars on FireEye and only had it configured to alert but not block. I can't understand why you would spend money on something and not let the product do its job. I mean, why would you do that? So, as I said, this was an entertaining piece, right? Later on, they talk about where this data was getting exfiltrated to, right? So the whole thing with point of sale, malware is to get credit card data, debit card data, and all of that stuff and send it off to a malicious website where that data can then be sold and auctioned off on the underground dark web, effectively the black market for criminal activities. So the Verizon team found that all of the data had been exfiltrated to foreign IP addresses. And now this made me think, ah, GeoIP blocking. We've been using GeoIP blocking now for quite some time. I consider it to be standard operating procedure. Why would you allow your perimeter security appliance to talk to or receive connections from? So we're talking about filtering ingress and egress traffic here based upon GeoIP blocking. Now, GeoIP blocking is geographic IP address basis. So let me give you an example. Let's say you don't do business with anyone in Syria. Well, you can probably not allow IP addresses from Syria then, right? Okay, that's the thought process you go through. And there's been some very interesting observations in the market from the widespread implementation of GYP blocking, which is that I've had many IT manager clients come back to me and say, well, you know, after we turned on GYP blocking the way that you recommended, because what I do is I supply them an input file of my customized list. And they're like, wow, you know, our block sites list has gone down to, like, instead of 5 pages, it's now half a page. And it's simply because the majority of the garbage traffic that they were seeing, at least in terms of external hack attempts, was coming from IP address associated with geographic spaces that they really were not doing any legitimate business with, right? So again, this is this whole concept of allow only what you need to allow, because it's impossible to come up with a list of the things to block. So the only strategy that's going to work is to come up with a list of the things that you need access to, right? That's called whitelisting versus blacklisting. So the in the end, the remediation and recovery for this thing, that was pretty humorous, this POS RAM scraping thing, was that they literally disconnected all of their systems from the internet, rebuilt their network from the ground up over several days, and then, of course, segmented their network, put two-factor authentication in place, strict firewall rules, and rebuilt servers and reset every password in the environment, you know? And this is, again, target all over again, because this particular breach was also talking about a company that did not have proper network segmentation. That was a big factor in the target breach, in that they did not have proper network segmentation. There was way too much bleed over of traffic from non-POS networks to POS networks. And the original infection vector that occurred to this company that breached their entire POS system and caused this giant catastrophe was literally a targeted phishing email. So for a long time now, I've been talking about how I don't really care what email system you're using. You need to have sophisticated, high-end, you know, anti-malware, antivirus, anti-phishing, anti-malicious link. You know, you really have to have some very, very high-end machine learning-backed, next-gen, otherwise known as Gen X sort of techniques and capabilities in that security system. And the latest Gartner report, which was just put out, like I saw it a few days ago, was evaluating all of the major market players, something like 15 of them in the security product space. And of course, yet again, Trend Micro, top of the heap, king of the hill. And no wonder, because their stuff is so effective and they just put so much time and energy into continuous improvement and dev. In April of this year, Trend rolled out all of its X-Gen security capabilities to the worry-free products, the office scan products, and a bunch of other products. And that was, if you were smart enough to go in and change those settings to turn on those now available advanced feature sets, then again, we have more protections against nasty ransomware and other things like that, such as WannaCry. And for QPC's clients, we manage those trend settings for all of our clients. And so what we do is we'll find out about the new feature set. We will test it ourselves for typically 15 to 30 days. And when we're really comfortable that we like the settings and we like how they're working and they're not breaking anything, then we will then roll those settings out to everyone. So this is just another fine example of how you can't buy security and then think that it maintains itself, because that doesn't happen. You need to have a really sophisticated security partner, like a managed services security practice. And that's what QPC is. You know, we manage that security service for our customers. And the Trend Micro Cloud App Security product is a product that plugs right into things like G Suite, which is Gmail. It plugs into the Office 365 and things like Dropbox for Business, right? And Box in general. So you can buy one product and have it cover a lot of your stuff, and it's incredibly affordable. I mean, you're looking at roughly about $50 per year per user, even for an extremely small shop that is very, very, very cost effective. I mean, obviously, if you go up in volume, your price per user is going to come down. So the the reason that this particular company was they started to put in two-factor authentication, of course, was they ended up finding out that the POS system did not have two-factor authentication. And the POS environment had been the first point of entry, and it was because the POS vendor set it up that way. And I'm not surprised by that because, by and large, all the experiences that I've ever had with POS vendors is that they do not really thoroughly understand or implement full PCI compliance throughout a client's environment. And technically, I don't think that they can. That sh and they shouldn't ever say that, I think there needs to be more truth. There's a lot of, like, they're just leaving details out. So, for example, you'll find a POS vendor that says, yes, all of our stuff is PCI compliant. Well, what does all of your stuff even mean? And the fact, though, that is the application itself might be PCI compliant, but that does not make the merchant and the merchant's environment PCI compliant. So the problem is that the vast majority of these merchants sit around and think that they have PCI compliance because they've purchased something that claims to certify that it's PCI compliant, when in reality, the POS vendor is not and never should be in the position of securing the merchant's entire environment, which is actually what's really required to achieve PCI compliance. So one of those things in PCI compliance is restricting remote access to the POS systems and really, having that remote control system use multi-factor authentication. I mean, that is verbatim pretty much what's in that particular section of PCI compliance. And what the Verizon team found was that in this particular circumstance, there was not what's called IP whitelisting for an ingress rule to allow remote access. And furthermore, multi-factor or two-factor authentication was not used for remote access into the POS system. So they needed to turn that on. Now, the next scenario, which is scenario 18, is about credential theft. And it ultimately comes down to a victim ended up being contacted by law enforcement, who law enforcement had informed them that several of their external facing IP addresses were involved in malicious activity and associated with an active investigation. Okay. Now, I was just at a big security conference out on the West Coast, and there was a statistic being bandied about, such as like how many percentage of breach victims realize, or by what mechanism do they realize that they've been breached? And in excess of 60% of them only realized it because law enforcement came and said, your stuff, it's trying to hack other people, right? And I've been saying for years that you need to be aware of and protect what is egressing your network, because if you allow malware to be egressing your network, then you're allowing your IP addresses to be used to harm other people and other systems. And what happens is, even if you're just ridiculously selfish and don't care about other people, what will and can happen is law enforcement contacts your ISP and just shuts your connection off. So think about the impact of that to your business. So if you don't prevent your IP addresses and your WAN connections from being used as part of something malicious by properly filtering egress traffic, which I think I could say, like, about 3 years ago, very few people were doing egress filtering. And there's probably tons of people that are still not doing egress filtering, but at least egress filtering is becoming more popular now. And in my viewpoint, egress filtering is what you should have been doing back in, 1997. I mean, it's been part of the cybersecurity framework since the very beginning. It's been part of the NIST SP800 cybersecurity set and standards. So, there's tons of reasons to do egress filtering. Well, the Verizon team then figured out how it was that this malware ended up getting on this company's systems, and it all came down to a SQL injection attack against a web server, and the web server was internet facing. They uploaded a web shell as a backdoor, continued the attack, basically exploited it, and then used traversal techniques. Now, my viewpoint is, why on earth would you host your own company's website with any level of connectivity back to your, corporate trusted network? Doing that, I just don't see the value in that at all on many levels. And from the perspective of the security risk, it doesn't seem to be worth it. And as these bad guys traversed through systems on the network, they ended up compromising several administrator accounts using various cached credential attacks, which is why I tell people never, 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 and one more time, never log in to a workstation with a domain admin account. Because that then loads the cached credentials of the domain admin account on the workstation, which can then be hacked and then used to escalate privileges onto servers. And oh, yep, lo and behold, that's exactly what happened in this scenario. And what the bad guys ended up finding was a spreadsheet that contained more than 100 usernames and passwords. So, and this was literally one of like the IT administrators was storing, 100 plus usernames and passwords. Now, I have to tell you, when I read this, my head about exploded because, Excel and spreadsheets are not a mechanism for storing usernames and passwords. This is so crazy, it's off the charts. The only thing that is appropriate for storing usernames and passwords is an encrypted multi-factor authentication, human presence required password known only to you, encrypted password safe. That's it. Anything less than that, boy, it better be a piece of paper and a pen. Because at least the piece of paper and the pen can't be remotely hacked. Now, you might lose it in a fire, and that's a risk because you can't back that up very easily. You certainly don't want to be scanning it and then storing some scanned PDF file on your system, right? That's also crazy. So, if you're not using an encrypted password safe, instead of what you're doing is storing usernames and passwords in a spreadsheet, just go get a fish and slap yourself with it. Because it's just that bad, okay? It's just that bad. Just stop. So, logging. We have to have logs. We have to know what's egressing the network. We have to have the cybersecurity kill chain. So many of these issues are just self-inflicted issues. This is not hard. None of it's hard. It's complicated, but it's not hard. And if you can't figure out how to do it on your own, then get competent help, please, because there's just no reason to be getting breached and hacked anymore. We know what we're doing at the security level. All right, I hope you enjoyed the show. You guys have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the 23rd Annual Gateway Technical College Foundation Scramble Golf Outing will take place Thursday, May 25th. Tickets are $185 a person and it is limited to 144 golfers. For more information or to register, visit gtc.edu/foundationscramble.
Support comes from the Lake Geneva Symphony presenting Beethoven 1, Pathway to Genius, Saturday, May 20th at Calvary Community Church in Williams Bay. The performance will give you an intriguing and fresh perspective on this groundbreaking symphony and composer. Tickets at lakegenevaorchestra.com.